Sometimes the thing finds us before we know how to find it, before we even know what it's called. It reaches through the static, through the noise, through the screen, and if we're lucky, we hear the call. Welcome to The Third Story. I'm Leo Sidran. Max Pollock was 5 years old, growing up in suburban Vienna, Austria, when he saw Fred Astaire dancing on television. He didn't know the story, he didn't know who Fred Astaire was, he didn't speak the language, but he knew he had to do whatever that was. The rhythm, the movement, the magic of it, it spoke to him. And it sent him on a lifelong journey that would eventually take him from Austria to Harlem to Havana and back again. Before he ever put a pair of taps on, Max was tapped in. His story is about answering the call, the one that doesn't make sense at first, but that won't leave you alone. It's about tap dance, jazz, improvisation, Afro-Cuban folklore, and identity. But more than anything, I think it's about what happens when you follow the rhythm that only you can hear. Today, Max Pollock is one of the most innovative tap dancers alive. His image is even featured on a U.S. postage stamp. He helped redefine the language of tap and body percussion, particularly in the Afro-Cuban space. He's also a vocalist, a drummer, and a composer. And I have to tell you, this episode came together unexpectedly for me. Last week, my friend Alexis Cuadrado, who was featured on an earlier episode of The Third Story, sent me the press release for Max Pollock's 25th anniversary performance at 92NY this month, and he suggested I might want to cover it for the radio or my Substack. I didn't know Max's work, but the story was intriguing, so I reached out to him for a short interview. And the conversation turned out to be so compelling, I decided to run it this week as a sneaky episode. Listening to Max talk about his journey, I was reminded of my father's interview with another Max, the drummer Max Roach, and their conversation from the 80s. Roach spoke about the influence of tap on jazz drummers and how the visual and rhythmic vocabulary of dancers shaped the evolution of jazz.
In fact, the earlier drummers, like Papa Joe Jones, Buddy Rich, these guys were tap dancers. They are tap, and good tap dancers. Philly Joe's a good tap dancer. I do a little rattling roll. You had to deal with it, and it was good for your feet and dealing with all the other things. But then J.C. Hurd, these people were dancers and then drummers, or dancers as well as drummers, and great dancers. They danced on theater, on the circuit, you know, in the variety shows that we had. You know, like the four-stroke roughs, you know, dilly-dat, 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 all those kind of things. They are things that tap dancers use. The sound of the paradiddle, the double paradiddle, and the triple paradiddle, which sounds just as it sounds, like paradiddle, paradiddle, ba da ba da ba da ba da ba da ba da ba da. Well, that also, the feet do that, double paradiddle, triple and cramps were, well, like roughs, you know, dilium, 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 dilium. When they would say dilyat, 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 dilyat. And of course, when I was growing up during the 40s, there was a lot of theater, and this was all over the country, of course. And they had variety shows, so you not only played with the band, but you also played with dancers, and you played with singers, and you had to play for the chorus girls and all these things. So dancing, tap dancing, was a headliner, especially when Bill Bojangles Robinson was alive. Well, tap dancers would sometimes head a show. If Bill Robinson was on a show with Duke Ellington, he'd get top billing. So the dancer, dance was big. It was like a pop singer. And so dancers were always on the streets. You could go on the street corner and you'd find dancers of all persuasions, just rattling and rattling and rattling, Groundhog, Baby Lawrence. The drummers and dancers would do duets. We'd play duets together where they would do some unbelievable things, and we would try to imitate or catch them, or they would try to catch or imitate some of the things that we were doing. So
it's a wonderful example of how the rhythm is kind of a universal feeling, and it's carried in different parts of the body. I mean, it might come up from the feet and be carried in the hands on the drums and go back to the feet.
Yeah.
But the rhythm is there. The rhythm exists.
It always exists. So what we started doing was, all right, then you have the snare. If you had, say, a four-stroke rough, which sounded like on the snare, like da-da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da, tap dancing would see ba-ba-da-ba, ba-ba-da-ba, ba-ba-da-ba. Now we had all four limbs, so we had the bass drum, and snare drum and side drums called tom-toms. So we say boobalom, boobalom. So we had all kinds of ways of doing it, and the dancers would kind of cock their ear at us. But most of these folks are just wonderful. When you listen to, say, a solo by people like Papa Joe Jones or Buddy Rich, for example, you hear a lot of dance steps because they are dancers, good dancers, that is.
And we should point out that the tradition is very much alive today. A modern drummer, Steve Gadd, started out as a tap dancer.
Yeah, so there you go.
It's still alive.
Still alive, yeah.
Third-story.com is the place to find the full archive, hundreds of deep dives with other artists who heard their own calls. Substack is where I'm publishing essays, updates, and long-form musings these days. It's leosidran.substack.com. And WBGO is our partner. Visit wbgo.org/studios to explore more of their award-winning content. Here's me and Max Pollock tapping in and talking it down. Hey, Max, how are you?
Good, good. Thank you. Thanks for calling. Here we go.
So I guess the first thing I want to know is you grew up in Austria. You were somehow called to dance despite your surroundings. Just describe to me what that first experience of realizing you wanted to dance, and particularly tap, was about.
That was me at 5 years old, sitting in front of my parents' black and white television back in Vienna in Austria, and seeing for the first time Fred Astaire tap dance in a wonderful movie. And I was so spellbound by his elegance and his effortless swinging persona that I immediately decided I have to learn how to do that, because that's cool. That was the beginning. And that was also a little bit of a problem, because in Vienna back then, there was simply no tap dance instruction, as my parents immediately found out. When I asked them, you know, can I learn how to do this? They tried to find instruction, but there was none. So for the next few years, as a little kid, I was basically relegated to catching those musicals whenever they came on television and watching, and basically starting to imitate what I saw Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly do on that screen. And I started just making stuff up. And that ended up actually being a blessing, because improvisation was my first access to this art form that I needed to learn somehow. I wanted to learn. And I just kind of taught myself by figuring something out. That came in handy later, because I was never afraid of improvisation. It was, to me, it was completely natural. So that was the beginning. And then I did find some instruction a couple of years later. I was very fortunate to find a master tap dancer who was one of the golden age of tap dance generation. His name was Carnell Lyons, and he happened to have moved to Berlin, to Europe, in the 60s. During the civil rights era, he decided to quit the United States because he felt like he could be treated like a human being if he moved to Europe, which was fortunate for me because I got to meet this man. He was already in his 70s. I was 14. And he basically took me under his wing and changed my life, you know, for the better. He was also one of the first black people I ever saw in my life, because I grew up in suburban, sheltered Vienna, you know, just outside Vienna. And this man, you know, came and was just like the embodiment of groove and of hipness. And like, he was just amazing. He blew my mind. And he also, in my teenage years, you know, he took me under his wing. He made me his assistant teaching. I already spoke very good English back then, and I became his translator. And I became his assistant showing the steps, because he had been a very athletic flash style tap dancer doing a lot of flips and splits like the Nicholas Brothers. If you know what who that is?
I do. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
He was that style of dancer. Like, he's super athletic. He used to twirl like a tray on his finger, you know, while tap dancing, sort of like, you know, half Harlem Globetrotter, yes, half bebop tap dancer. He was an unbelievable, like, superhero type person. And he didn't only teach me tap. He also told me about the realities of being a black man in the United States growing up. When he grew up, he was childhood friends with Charlie Parker. He grew up in Kansas City, and they used to busk together downtown Kansas City, Charlie Parker playing clarinet and Carnell Lyons tap dancing. This guy was part of jazz history.
Yeah.
He knew everybody who was anybody. He had tapped and performed with them. So, you know, he was imparting his wisdom and his experience to me, this, you know, gringo teenager in Austria. That was the beginning of this journey. And it helped me understand both jazz music, African traditions, tap dance from the perspective of a Black person, because he gave me that. He gave me a lot of insights from that side, you know. And that was hugely important for me. And I also started playing drums at that time and really like diving into jazz. So everything I read and everything I heard from that point on, I absorbed with that perspective that I got from Carnell. And that was really, really important for me.
You know, what's interesting is the first exposure you had was Fred Astaire, and you were attracted to the sort of the grace and the swing of it. But
yeah.
I mean, maybe intuitively you could have understood that it was tied to a legacy that was deeper than that. But I don't think there was probably any real way of knowing the door that you were about to walk through. And what I think is amazing is, you know, tap dance is something that was considered to be part of a well-rounded cultural diet for young white American kids. And you stumbled into this other version of the story that's, of course, much deeper and richer. And even though you were growing up in Europe, it actually sounds like you had more access to the source of it in some ways than the average American kid in the suburbs who might take a tap class as part of their parents hoping they have a well-rounded education growing up.
That's exactly right. You hit the nail on the head. That's exactly what it is. And, you know, that's one of the issues that me and my colleagues and peers who are all trying to do the same kind of thing have been working on for decades, is to try to change the way tap is taught. Because in general, as you said, it is taught in dance studios all over the country without the perspective of where it came from. You know, the kids don't learn what it is. They only learn steps without any meaning attached and without any context. You know, they don't know who first did these kinds of steps, how it developed. They don't know the history and the links between tap dance and jazz music. They don't know any of that. They just learn tricky steps that look interesting and look risky or whatever, and they do it for points. And this is, for me, is the biggest mistake, that nowadays, especially in the last, let's say, 10, 15 years, any child growing up in the United States has only seen dance in the context of a competition on television, in reality shows. That's the only context they see dance in, because there are no accessible dance performances in the broader, let's say, United States. You can't just go and see dance. Nobody does that. You have to be in New York or in LA or in San Francisco. Yeah, of course, there you can go see dance. But anywhere else, you don't see dance. You only see dance on television as a competition. That's the only context you see it in. So these kids grow up thinking tap dance is a sport. That's a very, 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 very deep mistake.
What does dance do that other forms of expression don't do? I mean, it's nonverbal.
Mm-hmm.
It expresses the human experience, but in ways that are hard to fully explain, although we can feel them. What in your mind, especially given, you know, I mean, it's always hard times somewhere, but man, it's hard to find a corner of the planet that isn't going through something really transformational and existential right now. What can dance do for those who are exposed to it, do you think?
Well, dance is, as you said, it's a door linking your own personal experience to somebody else's experience. Because it's visual, it's nonverbal, anybody, independent of language, thank God, even just watching, even if you don't have music, you can watch somebody express, even if you're watching somebody tap dance and you cannot hear them, you can see them express something. That's one of the biggest powers of dance, that it visually translates something that acting and speaking can do, and something that music and playing can do through just the visual. That's a superpower that dance has. But then you also have the added bonus, especially with percussive dance, that we make our own music while we dance. And that's another factor that makes it super relatable. And in my experience, I can relate even to children who are like 1 year old or 2 years old. They will start imitating what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
and relate my experience to their experience, even though their experience is maybe a year of life. They know what it's like to clap their hands together and to stomp their feet on the ground. You know, that's the beauty of this kind of dance, whether it's tap dance or katak or flamenco or stepping, you know, things are so visceral that they immediately connect to everybody's inner child. And the inner child is really, that's where we are the richest.
Is it your belief that everybody can dance? Everybody has an inner dancer inside them?
100%. I spend a lot of my time now teaching people who are not fully physically able to express everything that they would like to express. I work a lot with people who have Parkinson's disease, people who are deaf mute, people who are blind, Alzheimer's, you know, cognitive disorder people. It is the strongest, most magical medicine you can have, you can find on the planet. Is music and movement. Connected to rhythm, it's even more powerful, I would say.
I want to talk a little bit about the journey. You eventually come to the States. You had been exposed to one great Black American tap dancer who maybe,
correct,
I can imagine, gave you a sense of the kinds of people that you might find when you came here. I mean, did you realize how rare that was, or did you think you were going to find, you know, 20 more Carnells when you got here?
I wasn't sure. However, Carnell did tell me about his friends who were still around, and he shared with me videos, which, you know, back in the 80s, that was hard to come by. This was like the mid 80s, and footage that you can now see on YouTube any second of the day, videos were very, very rare.
Yeah.
You could not find this stuff. And he made me copies. He made me copies and handed me these videotapes so that I could study them of other great tap dancers, all of whom he knew personally, of course. He would watch this stuff together and he would give me, like, he would say, okay, so this is Ralph Brown and he did bebop stuff. And, you know, and this is Honey Coles and he was really elegant and he did this soft shoe and really slow and da, da, da. And he would give me a little bit of background on each dancer. This is also how I first saw Gregory Hines and Sam Cape Jr., Jimmy Slide, like all these legendary, amazing African-American tap dancers who I had never heard of before. So Carnell really opened that whole wealth, you know, of information to me. And then when I came here, I came to New York to start working with a company called Manhattan Tap under the direction of Heather Cornell, who's also an amazing tap dance master and who helped usher in the tap dance renaissance by helping masters of that generation come back to performing. Because during the 60s and 70s, a lot of these great tap dancers basically lost their work because the interest just went away. For one thing, it was because rock and roll and amplified music just became commonplace and was just too loud for tap dancing. And the second thing that often is overlooked is the civil rights movement. And for Black people in the, especially the late 60s, tap dancing became a symbol of Uncle Tom. And this is really crucial. And Gregory Hines explains this on a couple of interviews. At that point, no Black person would send their child to tap dance class because they thought it was representative of slavery, essentially.
Yeah.
And of you know, sucking up to the masa, you know?
Yes.
That's a really, really tragic fact that contributed to when I came here in the early 90s, there was barely any Black person tap dancing. Other than the old masters who were still tap dancing or had started again. And then you're like two or three other kids, you know, that ended up then in Black and Blue, in shows like Black and Blue, Black Broadway shows.
Yes.
But there were very, very few. It was all white people. And frankly, a lot of Europeans and Japanese people came over to study tap.
Was there a relationship at that point between, let's say, Afro-Caribbean music and culture and tap?
Not really. There was, of course, always a rhythmic connection. And there were tap dancers who would tap dance to some sort of like Latin-tinged jazz tunes. But there was nobody who was tap dancing, especially like Afro-Cuban folklore or hardcore salsa or Latin jazz, like I ended up doing. Because I was looking for that when I started studying at the New School. I went to the New School for drum set because I was already a drummer, and they put me in the second year when I auditioned and then took this class with Bobby Sanabria, Afro-Cuban Ensemble. And that's where I started learning the clave, you know, an Afro-Cuban language and rhythmic vocabulary. And I asked Bobby, I said, I'm a tap dancer besides being a drummer, and I'm looking for people who tap dance this stuff. Can you point me to some? And he said, well, there aren't any. And I said, what? I was in complete disbelief, you know, because to me it was so natural. Like, that can't be true. There must be like hundreds of people doing this. And he said, no, there's nobody dancing actual Cuban music with tap. And then I said, well, then I think I would like to do it. And he said, okay, well, then you have to ask yourself one important question. Do you want to tap dance to Cuban music, or do you want to tap dance Cuban music?
I love that. The significance of one small word, of the word to, changes the context completely. Do you want to tap dance to it, or do you want to do it?
Exactly. Yeah. And then I said, no, I want to tap dance Cuban music. And he said, okay, if you want to tap dance Cuban music, you have to be able to tap dance and play clave at the same time.
Mm.
And that was the beginning of me developing my own style, because I understood immediately, oh, whoa, that's a very profound difference to regular tap dancing. If you have to tap dance and do another rhythmic level at the same time, that's a whole different thing that nobody has ever tried before.
Hmm.
That's what I went in for. And, you know, I started practicing. This was in 1994. That's when I started practicing. And for many years, I was just struggling. And there was a lot of crying and a lot of frustration, but a lot of practice. And then over the years, you know, I got some stuff together. And then I started performing in jam sessions, in Latin jazz jam sessions at the New York Poets Cafe. And when I was sitting in there one time, dancers from Los Muñequitos de Matanzas came in from Cuba, from Matanzas.
Yes.
They saw me dance. And afterwards, they came up to me and they asked me who my teacher was, who had taught me how to dance like this, integrating, you know, the rumba moves and the clave and all that. And I said, well, for this, I didn't have a teacher. I put this together myself. And then they said, oh, really? Well, can you teach us, please? Because we would like to dance like you.
Hmm.
You know, and this is coming from like the most amazing dancers I had ever seen. I had seen them in Central Park perform. And to me, they were like gods. You know, they were so amazing with all the rhythmic complexity and the smoothness of their movement and all the meaning that was clearly in every move of every finger. You know, so to me, they were like superheroes. And here they're approaching me, asking me to teach them something. I'm like, huh? Oh, sure. Yeah, of course. If you would like, I can show you how I do this. Sure. That was the beginning of our relationship. And then I gave them some tap shoes and we met up in a studio and I showed them a little bit of sort of like a regular jazz tap dance technique that is involved to get the sounds out of the feet. And then I showed them how I produce their rhythms with my feet and with my body percussion. And they took to it like fish in water. Like, woof,
yeah.
You know? It's a very clear sign. This is definitely a thing. I'm onto something here and I need to stick with this. This is a good idea. When I think back, I always go like, did this really happen to me? You know, all the things that followed with me traveling to Cuba and them inviting me to perform with them for Fidel Castro and in some places that were so remote, performing for some people that were so African. I thought I was in Africa.
Yeah.
Like this was in Cuba, you know? Because they play for everybody. They don't only play for the crowned heads. They play in like in some sugar factory in the middle of the country, you know, whereas there's nothing other than sugar fields. You know, we rode out there with a bus and they performed for the factory workers there. Mm. It was one of the greatest experiences I ever had because these people were clearly didn't have the wherewithal to go to Havana and go to a theater.
Yeah.
They were like plantation workers and they were digging the tap dancing. It was crazy. It was so beautiful. And, you know, I felt like I was closer to the roots than I could have ever been anywhere else other than going to Africa.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, the feeling of performing with Los Muñequitos de Matanzas is also altogether something I don't even know what to call it. They make you levitate. Mm. They start playing and their groove is so, because they've been playing this kind of music for like over 70 years now. You know, for generations.
Yeah.
When they get into that groove, it feels like you're leaving the floor. Like it's so powerful. It's incredible. And I feel so blessed and so incredibly fortunate that they found me, that they recognized what I was doing as valuable. You know, that to me is like the biggest recognition I could ever hope for.
Yeah.
You know?
I went to Cuba once 10 years ago. And one of the things I felt when I was there was, you know, this is a place that has very little economic capital and enormous human capital. And they understood that what they were able to do was lift up the potential of what we are able to do with our just our bodies, you know, whether it's like investing in dance or in, you know, in the sciences also to some extent, but the arts in general, it was like, okay, if you don't have any industrialized economy, what can you make? You can make art.
That's exactly it. And on the spiritual level too, Afro-Cuban religious scene is so vibrant there. And it is so important as a generator, power generator, you know, this spirituality gives people the energy to maintain their lives, you know, and I never understood it until I was there, how powerful this is and how it's also, it's not about whether they're singing the right notes. You know, you go to some backyard ceremony and people sing out of tune and it doesn't matter. It's still amazing. It's about the conviction and it's about the fervor and the belief and everybody wanting to uplift each other. That's one thing that I really understood. The music is so good because it's always played for the community. It comes out of the community and the energy goes back into the community and lifts everybody up. That's sort of the essence that I gathered. And that's what I try to share with people, this understanding that I was able to absorb there.
So let's talk about Rumba Tap and where that fits in and what that is specific to this Cuban experience. Is it tied to when you went to Cuba?
Absolutely, yeah, because what I do is basically integrating Afro-Cuban folkloric musical and movement concepts and singing with tap dance and body percussion, all done at the same time, simultaneously by one body or in extension by several bodies in several different parts, just like the folkloric drums are, you know, like layered in different parts. When I went there, people saw me do my thing, especially the muñequitos. They looked at what I was doing and they said, well, this is rumba tap. And I said, oh, you say it, then it must be right. If the rumberos of the rumberos, the most respected people on in that scene, call it that, who am I to say that they're not correct? However, in the last 10 years, I've stopped using that term because it led to misunderstandings and problems in getting work, because the word tap dance alone evokes completely wrong associations in most people's minds, because they don't really know, most people don't really know what tap dance even is, and even less people know what rumba really is. So when you put these two words together, 99% of people in the world have the wildest, very, very wrong associations just from the words. And that leads to them thinking, well, this got to be some really crazy stuff. That's the problem I was having or experiencing. You know, I decided to not use that term anymore, because also then I started to do things that were not only Afro-Cuban folklore and not only tap dance. You know, like in our presentation, we do many other things that are beyond, you know, that use other styles of music from other countries, use classical music. I do a lot of chamber music and stuff like that. I sing a lot of things that are not rumba, you know, so it became a little bit of not really describing the full picture, only describing like the upper left corner.
It was limiting in a way.
It was limiting. Yeah, exactly. And it just led to, it was like, it was a marketing mistake, let's just say, although it's not wrong. You know, it does describe what's happening, but it doesn't describe everything that's happening.
Sure. So you've got this event next week, which is being billed as, and I understand we all need reasons to promote things sometimes, but it's being billed as the 25th anniversary. So what anniversary are we celebrating?
So the very first performance under the title Rumba Tap, or Max Pollock's Rumba Tap, happened in August 1999. And featured Bárbaro Ramos of Los Muñequitos de Matanzas. And Bárbaro Ramos will also be performing next Thursday with me, with his son, Yunisclevis Ramos, and with his nephew, Jaime Ramos, both of whom were about 5 to 7 years old the first time I went to Cuba. And I have video of them when I give them their first tap shoes and I show them their first tap steps. So this is like a full circle moment for me. It is indeed the 25th, at this point, actually the 26th already, almost, anniversary of the first performance of me presenting my work, presenting this whole concept under the name Rumba Tap with me as the leader.
Congratulations. That is worth celebrating. I guess the question to just sort of wrap up is, what do you make of this experience that starts, as you laid it out, as a young boy in Austria, seeing a video I mean, there is something, honestly, a little mystical about the whole thing.
Mm.
What is your take on it? And I guess if you're able to extrapolate it, like what it means for young people today who maybe are called to the music and they don't know why or what it means to them. You must have over the years thought, how did this happen to me? Like, what is this?
Almost every day.
Yeah.
To me, it's really a spiritual journey that I feel I was taken on, not necessarily by just seeing a musical with Fred Astaire, although that was the beginning, because it started with magic. I would definitely say that. Me seeing this person move with such elegance and energy, it was spellbinding. And I then followed instinctively always those things that caught me in a spell, whether it was music, rhythm, movement, someone's singing voice. I always tried to just listen to my gut. And when this little bell inside me went ding, 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 I just said, okay, this deserves my attention and deserves my energy. I'm going to check this out and I'm going to work on this. And that's really the compass I've been following. My instinctive compass, where when my emotions, when my feelings respond in a certain way, I know this is the truth speaking to me in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Try to follow the truth. And in a way, that's helped me find myself. When you're interested in so many things, of course, there are many moments where you doubt yourself and you're not sure, like, what am I? Who am I? Why am I going in this direction after I was just going in that direction? Shouldn't I be focusing on this rather than that? But I'm glad I followed my instinct, because every aspect of the things that I ended up studying helped me to solidify my base that I was standing on so that I could take the next step. Everything now makes complete sense to me. And although during the process over the years, I often was doubting myself and saying, like, oh man, like, this is not going anywhere, or people are not responding. In the beginning, when I started doing this mixture of Afro-Cuban folklore and rhythm and songs with tap dance, the tap community really didn't embrace it. People were like, what is this? You know, what should we do with this? Because there was too much complexity, and I was too deep in it, studying it, to see that for an outsider, it would read like that.
Yeah.
I couldn't see the forest for the trees. So it took some time for me to realize, oh, that, like, nobody can really understand this other than me. I need to step back and I need to help people feel this by giving them more context. That's how the band evolved from body percussion and singing. Like, that was too hard for people to grasp. So I had to put some instruments around it and some harmonic and melodic context to help people hear what I was hearing. You know,
it actually reminds me, I interviewed Melinda Sullivan last year in LA, who had made a record with Larry Goldings. One of the questions I asked her was what it means to tap in a less performative way, like in the studio, and where groove becomes maybe more of a priority than, you know, whatever is happening visually, because of course on a record, you can't see a record. And just to what extent the sort of visual aspect of tap is at the forefront, or if it's only one of the aspects that matters, you know, because I found her to be so deeply grooving on that record. And that's kind of what you're talking about too, is like, in order to make this music palpable, you had to put other instruments around it so people could see, oh, this is an instrument. This is dance, but it's also an instrument.
When you're doing stuff that's rhythmically too complex for people to comprehend, it'll just go over their head, you know? And it was for me actually also really interesting, because that started my process of really becoming a composer and an arranger, you know? And then I went from it at, I went at it from the drummer's perspective, you know, like, I have to arrange this so that every part folds in with the other part, including the tap and the body percussion. So like on my CD, there is no other percussion instruments other than tap dance and body percussion. There are saxophones, there are vocalists, there's a marimba. And then, you know, there's a guest tracks where there is a conga player featured. But in general, the concept is that the percussion is, the drums are basically all tap dance and body percussion. So I have recorded quite a lot, more than most tap dancers, I would think.
Yeah.
And because I'm a musician also, and I've recorded percussion and drumming as much as I have recorded tap dancing. So to me, that aspect was always at the forefront. And to me, the music is always going first. You know, one of the things that's tricky when you're pigeonholed as a dance company, which I don't think I have. I don't have a dance company. I have a band. I have an orchestra or a chamber music ensemble. That's what I usually call it.
Yeah.
I need backline. I need sound. I need monitors. You know, I need microphones. I'm not a dance company that walks onto a rubber stage and puts on a CD and just moves around.
Yeah.
You know, that's exactly what I don't do. Oftentimes when people were trying to book me, they were sort of expecting that. And then I come with all these musical demands and they're like, we don't have that. You know, and like, well, you know, then this is not the right venue if you don't have that.
Yeah.
We play a concert. That's one of the challenges. So the aspect of what you hear being more important than what you see, of course, is on the in the forefront when you're doing a CD, when you're doing an audio recording. And when I was putting together the CD, that was one of the toughest things, was to take a show that was visual, you know, had a lot of visual aspects, and a lot of visual cues to the band too, from like, you know, when we do this movement, you change to this section, you know, and in the recording, that's very difficult to get that across. You know, when you don't see the movements, you'd have to take the visual drama out, and the audible drama has to be at the forefront. It's a laborious process, but it's possible. And I find it really, really interesting. And I do think listening to recorded tap dancing is still very, very interesting.
Yeah. Well, congratulations and thanks for taking time to talk about it. What a cool story, sure. Max.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It was really great to talk with you. And you clearly also have an understanding, you know, of what all this means. That makes a big difference. You know, sometimes people just don't get what it is that I'm really talking about, but you do.
This has been a WBGO Studios production. To learn more about WBGO Studios' award-winning podcasts, special concerts, live streams, and more, visit wbgo.org/studios.